Let's just roll this and we'll see.
Rolling.
Okay. So we always kind of start with a, you know, like to tell the truth. So would you sign in, please?
Hi, this is Roger Miller from Mission of Bremen.
And
here I am.
Here you are. And he didn't even show me his driver's license, so we don't really know that this is really him. But
it's quite possible.
There's also a whole posse in the studio here. So if everybody here, yes, you're shushing. If anybody, we like that. We like that here. We like noise. We like background. We like a live audience. So whatever. And I can edit you out afterwards anyway. So it doesn't matter. So you're not actually in San Francisco on mob business.
Mob business today.
You're not here.
Here.
You're here with this thing. So I'm going to, before we get deep into the, you know, the Mission of Burma psyche, you're here with the Alloy Orchestra. So for those who don't know about, you know, on your website, on the Mission of Burma website, there's this great little road map of the members of the band and the little.
Great.
You don't even know.
I don't go to the website.
You don't eat your own. You don't eat the food you cook. It's a lot easier. But there's this little dotted lines, and they kind of then go over here and over there, and nobody can see this because it's not television. And there's all of these other things that you do. So let's
something of that.
Yeah. So Alloy Orchestra. Let's talk about why you're here for that. So the fans know there's something a little deeper.
There's something
not
little,
the Mission of Burma is not deep.
I don't know if it's any deeper, but it's certainly different.
Exactly. So tell us about it. Sure.
Alloy Orchestra, it's a three-piece band. I play keyboards, kind of orchestral stuff, and there's two guys who play a rack of junk metal about 10 feet tall and 15 feet long, and then they also play drums. They're basically percussionists, and one also plays clarinet, another one also plays accordion. And we do a silent film accompaniment, and that's all we do. We fly to film festivals, and we're just here in San Francisco doing Buster Keaton's The General and Dans la Nuit, which is a relatively obscure French murder mystery.
And how did that occur? I mean, were you just into classic films and one day said, these need a different kind of soundtrack?
No, David Kleiler, the elder, and David Kleiler, the younger, lives in L.A. And he's
L&A.
On this little L&A. And he's on that little
those
dotted
are two
thing.
Places. There's like T&A and then there's L&A.
And Dave lives somewhere between those. Does he still live in L.A.? We think he does. But he's on, Dave Kleiler, the younger, is on one of those dotted things. I haven't been to it, but I know he's on there.
The thing you haven't been to that you know exists.
That I know exists.
Right.
But his dad was, he and his dad would go see Mission of Burma. Like his dad, you know, 10 years older than me, and he's 10 years younger than me or whatever it is. So we're kind of in the middle. But he was doing silent film accompaniment with his Rear Window, like alternative film showings, and he dragged me and Martin when Burma folded to do silent film accompaniment. And then my other friends, who are now the two guys in the Alloy Orchestra, they were doing silent film accompaniment, and they got started with the Alloy Orchestra. And when the other keyboard player left the planet, I was the guy who was called.
Are you often called when people leave the planet?
Usually, yeah.
It's kind of, that's a good t-shirt. I'm called when people leave the planet.
That's me.
So do you ever... You get to watch the films time and time again, obviously.
Yeah, we're tight to the film.
But every once in a while, do you just kind of let the rock and roll man take over and say, you know, I just want to do a drum solo here?
No, we never do that.
Right.
But that's what's interesting. I mean, it's fun, really fun
it's
to do.
It's disciplined, right?
In Burma, you can do whatever you want. Like if I say, well, let's take this apart here and we'll just shred it, you know, live. But when you're working with a film, the film isn't going to improvise with you. You know, the film's going to keep going. So you got to... you're at the mercy of the film. That's probably the biggest difference.
It's kind of good. I think that more people who have been in rock and roll should have the experience of that kind of discipline.
It could be.
In some way, shape, or form.
Could be.
All right. So we started this kind of offline, as they say. But let me take you back to Boston, 1979. It really was quite a scene. The Rat, BCN, nobody knows what we're talking about here, but some people will. Newbery Comics had a crush on Tammy Heidi at that moment in time and can still go see her in L.A., except she's a lot older. But there was so much energy.
I bet she is.
Yeah, she is, but still cute. And still tough as nails. But so much energy at one time in one city, and I know that for those of us that were there and those of us that even are in San Francisco, if you get a bunch of people who were in Boston during that time together, you don't really want to be, if you're not in the conversation, you don't want to be in the conversation because it's kind of like this weird fraternity is the only
like
way to describe
it. Closed society. Yeah.
And yet it was a huge closed society because for those who weren't there, it really, I mean, when you read Mission of Burma stuff, you know, it says that you affected everything there was that ever happened in the entire world of punk rock.
That's right. That's a joke. I don't think that's like about that. Yeah.
But the scene, and I ask everybody this because we've had Robin Lane on recently. We've had the Fools. Scarily enough, Brad Delp from Boston was on the show recently, which is even scarier.
Oh, that's bizarre.
That is bizarre. But because I spent so much time there, I've gone out of my way to make all these connections. And everybody has a different, you know, was there something in the water? Because it's an amazing, and to this day, people talk about the San Francisco music scene, and then they talk about the Boston music scene, and there's just...
I mean, I don't know if it's...
There was never an end of a question there, but you know where I'm going.
Right. I mean, it was pretty amazing. I mean, I moved to Boston in 78, and that was just, you know, I walked down the street. I was there to study to be a piano technician. And I walked down the street, and it was near Mass Art, and said, "Girls, La Peste, Films, Human Sexual Response." I had no idea which was the band, which were the films, but it was like, I have to go see this show. And that was pretty much the beginning.
Right.
For me. I mean, the girls killed me.
So do you have any opinion of why, you know, I mean, we have that Rhino compilation that I was looking at, you know, Mass Ave, which, you know, is out of print now, but it sold a ton. And I imagine that 99% of the people who bought it had no idea what that was all about. And yet they did.
But, you know, it's like, towns have, I mean, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan during the 60s, and Ann Arbor was a hotbed in Michigan.
Right.
There was lots of, you know, the Amboy Dukes, MC5, SRC, the Rationals. These were like really great rock bands. And then, you know, what's come out of Ann Arbor since? Nothing. Like the little town.
Wood.
What?
Wood.
Wood.
Furniture. Isn't there a lot of furniture in Ann Arbor?
I had some furniture.
I think a lot of furniture is made there.
No, not.
Not Ann Arbor?
Not too much.
There's a good film festival.
There is a good film festival.
There you go.
But, you know, to me, it's like the town goes up and you squish Ann Arbor down and it comes up over here. And the town, this town's hot. And then you squish, you know, Athens, Georgia down here. And then Austin, Texas rises up over here. It's the same shit's going to come out of the ground no matter what. But it just keeps moving where it comes out of. But to me, like that time period for the Boston
scene. But that was
a
really compressed, amazing. I mean, if you were to
list
the number
of bands. Yeah, I thought it was pretty incredible. But I mean, I'm not as... I mean, I thought it was an amazing time. I have no idea that if Boston was any greater than San Francisco or... You know, I mean, the L.A. punk scene was pretty... You know, you got the Minutemen, Black Flag, and the Circle Jerks. I mean, you know, and X. I mean, that's a pretty incredible scene.
Absolutely.
And the early scene in New York with the Heads, you know, but the New York scene kind of went down and then the energy went up somewhere else, like, let's say, Boston. I mean, I'm not discounting it. But,
no, but
you know,
that's the first time I've heard somebody speak of it that way, and I think it's actually true. I think it's, you know, because...
Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, no, I think it's it makes sense.
I believe it.
But do you think that Rick Hart, you know, with Ace of Hearts, do you think that he had something going there that would be hard to duplicate today with what's going on?
I mean, well, yeah. I mean, it was naive then. You know, no one knew what they were doing. Now, you know, the indie market is almost a controlled market. You know, this market, people go, they market stuff for the, you know, college radio, which at that time, people didn't do that. They just had no idea.
They just put out music.
Yeah, there was no concept of it being a market. And Rick was just there at the right time, you know, and he had his vision, and so it worked, just like Mission of Burma was there at the right time. Whatever.
So the Mission of Burma sound back then, I mean, mixer guitars, but then Martin's tape loops.
Taken over by Bob Weston now, yeah.
Right. Where did that influence come from? I mean, you know, you were there. You like you said, you showed up from Ann Arbor, and next thing you know, there you are, and you're doing this. Where do you think it all kind of came from? Because you did have something different and continue to a great extent. I mean, there was a vision there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I of all the guys in the band, I was the one who had, I mean, 10 years earlier, I started Sprott and Lair, which was my first original band. I've just been doing it ever since. So that's just what I did. I've always led bands. Clint had never written a song before Peking Spring. That was the very first song he ever wrote in his life. You know, I mean, to me, that's like, you know, Athena springing out of Zeus's thighs. Like, how did that come out fully formed? And Peter hadn't really written anything either. But everybody brought in their own influences. And I joined, what am I trying to say here? I was confused. But in The Moving Parts, which was the band before, I joined, the guitar player vanished, and I joined as the replacement guitarist, and I hit it off really well with Clint. And I had already kind of brought in this kind of what made sense to me, this, you know, kind of mixture of art rock stuff. And I've been to music school, I've been to free jazz, and then, you know, punk rock, the Ramones. You kind of start squishing them together. And then when Moving Parts folded and Clint and I decided we're going to form what, or kind of half decided we were going to form what became Burma, Clint, because it was his first time, he just stripped it down. And I, you know, in my leftover residue, I thought, well, I was going to be doing a lot of guitar solos. I was going to be this guitar hero with guitar solos.
Right.
And, you know, I was completely wrong. And I didn't even write songs that had guitar solos, so I was seriously wrong. But, you know, you took all, okay, you take Clint and my influences, and then you get Peter in there, and you have like this, I mean, I come from, you know, you can hear some of the MC5 kind of sound in what I
absolutely
play. And yet I'm like a Syd Barrett guitar head, and I really like the way he plays. You know, so you squeeze Syd Barrett and the MC5 together, and you kind of get my kind of thing. But then Martin, I'd known Martin for years. He was also from Ann Arbor. And when he moved into the house where Mission of Burma was rehearsing, he had brought in a tape loop machine. He was starting to get into tape loops. And so he and I did some experiments, mostly with piano. It was more overtly Frippertronic kind of bass, because these were Martin's ideas. And then when Burma had the song New Disco, and I realized that I'd written this just upwardly cascading vocal line, I thought, well, you know, there's Martin, here's the tape loop, you just loop each thing. And so that was the first song that he was involved with. And it's, you know, I don't know.
It's hard to go back and figure out how something happened.
Yeah,
but
there's
it's
no
just,
way. You know,
but
yeah.
but it did take off. And I think that's a kind of a good segue. So we play something, we decided we'd play something old first.
Let's do that.
And what are we going to listen to? You had an interesting description.
Which, oh, New Nails?
Yeah. You said something about it.
Well, and if you're going to play, that's when I reach for my revolver, then New Nails is the natural antidote, whereas Revolver is relatively listener-friendly. New Nails is pretty much pure irritation.
So we're going to just really annoy people in the next few minutes.
Damn tootin'.
Excellent. Let's do it.
Singing after the first. Maybe.
There once was a special book. It got changed by fascist crooks. Save me, please, for I am weak. There once was some great ideas. Now they're watered down to fizz. Save me, please, for I am weak. Save me, please, for I'm weak.
You were saying that live you really managed to get people to leave the club.
Well, in the old days, yeah, it was pretty common. I mean, sure, we'd drive them off. And, you know, so we'd play some of these songs, and they'd just, people would not get it at all.
Oh, you know,
some of them they would.
Bummer for that, right?
Well, it didn't really matter to us after a while. They seem to get them now. It's kind of amazing.
Well, funny you should mention that. I was just saying it while we were listening to the song. I'm going to read you from... I love doing allmusic.com because, you know, so many people go there to find out about a band. You know, they hear about a band and they say, you know, I want to find out more. And so they read the description and that becomes their, the internet has done that for us. You don't call someone and say, what's the band like? You go to allmusic.com.
I've never been there, but.
Burma's darker songwriting, impulses, and tendencies towards longish repetitive jams capable of boring holes into your skull.
We don't jam.
Wait, I'm going to keep going.
Okay.
Then you can write them a note. What Burma added was a sonic texture through the use of extreme volume. Roger Miller's guitar enveloped, as opposed to enveloped, the band in thick, distorted, cascading chords erupting into squealing, I sound like Casey Kasem, squealing solos and intentional squalls of feedback. With Prescott and Conley furiously bashing in support, the band's sound was extremely physical, ask anyone who saw them live, to the point of leaving the audience feeling slightly bruised, battered, but extremely happy.
Okay. I accept that.
And there you are.
There was another review, I think when we played Providence, they said Mission to Burma didn't so much entertain as overwhelm their audience. I was like, okay. Is that good? I don't know.
Seems for Mission to Burma,
it's not my problem.
It seems that for the band there's always been a war or a political cause worth writing about. I mean,
there's always been what?
There's always been something, you know, something, a war or a political cause. There's always been something worth writing about for the band. Intentional? I mean, when you set out to write songs.
I don't think we've ever written a political song except for Wounded World, which was not written for Mission of Burma.
Do you think that's when I reach for my revolver? People don't see
it's
this?
Not, well,
I mean, I know it's not intended to be, but.
I don't care what people see. I mean, all the songs are, you know, any good song, people should be able to read stuff into it and get. You know, pick a line and then come out with whatever they want it to be, like a little Rorschach test. But from our point of view, we did nothing that was overtly political.
Good. I did that to get exactly that reaction. Because the interesting thing that I think the perception of punk rock, and especially back then, is that it wasn't really songs. That they were diatribes, that they were out to annoy, that they were out to change the world. And I don't think that's what you did. I don't think that's, you know, what the songs were about.
Probably not.
There you go. So, which leads me to, when you formed the band, what did you set out to do? Did you set out to do anything? Did you say, we're doing this band and we want to do this?
More musical and selfish. You know, Clint and I, we'd just come out of the Moving Parts with Lindgren, Eric Lindgren, who later was in Birdsongs, The Mess of Oak with me. There's about a year where he and I didn't want to talk to each other, and then we became good friends again. And he was doing he was a keyboard player, and it was very art rocky. And some of the guitar parts, I would read them on paper, which was fine because I'd come out of music school and I didn't find that alienating. But then as the band progressed and I steeped myself more in punk rock and I started immediately bonded with Clint, we'd do some of these complicated songs and Clint and I would just play E. We'd just sit there playing E's and Eric would try to get us to play these, you know, more comp, you know, do it like this. And we would just be gazing off in space, hitting E. It was very satisfying. Though, you know, I have nothing, I mean, I'm really good friend with Eric now. But so, I mean, our thing was just take it back just to the dirt and then rebuild it from there. But of course, nobody ever really does that. Our influences are so many. But that was kind of the idea, that just strip it down. And I mean, like the song New Disco, which is barely a song at all. But that was just like a little bridge in this, one of my earliest tunes, was a real complicated song. And Clint and Peter goes, well, Roger... that's really the only good part in the song. And so, okay, you know, I'm pretty easygoing overall. And I agreed, and so then it became whatever, you know, just a mantra, you know. And even Secrets is just one chord.
So do you think, I mean, there is this perception of punk, and maybe it's more true today because, you know, it's like anybody can form a band, go in their bedroom, you know, use Pro Tools or whatever.
That's a whole different thing, though.
And but that's, so back then.
I mean, DIY, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah, was right. Do you think that it would be amazing to people to know that so many of the people that played in bands like Mission to Burma did go to music school, did know music, you know, and that there was always somebody in that you know, in those bands that you're saying, you know, we, you know, purposely played E or whatever it is.
Right.
There was reason behind that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, a band like Wire, like, I don't think those guys had any knowledge, you know, studied knowledge, and they were one of the most powerful groups of the era. I mean, it just so happened that I'd been to musical. I could have been a composition teacher, but instead I became a punk rock guitar player, you know?
Amazing, isn't it?
It makes more sense.
I guess it does. So the new CD, is it a true reunion, or do you just have a lot of things, you know, to say, and you just decided to do it? I mean, I know you did the quote, you know, the get back together a couple of years ago, but that didn't result in an album, and now this has resulted in a real live, brand new, all new material.
Well, actually, you know, three or four old tunes, but
right. So, are you back together per se, or are you going to tour for a while, or you've never been apart?
I mean, for those last. When we started playing again 2 years ago, basically we've kept playing. We've never stopped. But it would be like we'd play three shows every 3 months. So we'd do our three shows. 2 days later, we'd forget that we'd done them, and we'd forget about the band till we're ready to play the next three shows 3 months later. But in that time, the way I am designed or have been designed through my life, you know, I make a living as a musician. So if I'm not making music for the band isn't really alive. So I kept writing more than anybody else, but Peter would also be writing songs. And the very first show that we did, all of us brought in a new song. Clint brought in one, Peter. I actually hadn't been playing guitar for a while, so I brought in Wounded World, which I wrote for No Man, you know, 10 years earlier about the first war in Iraq. And it was appropriate at that point for Afghanistan. But then after that, once I start playing guitar and I start performing guitar, the stuff starts coming out. You know, and then so over those every 3 months we'd play another three shows. I would have a new song, or Pete would also, and then they just started piling up, you know. And so then we made a record.
So the song we're about to play, Dirt.
Dirt.
What's it about?
Well, Clint wrote that
song. Is it about dirt?
What is dirt? Why does the dirt just sit there?
Yeah, exactly.
But this is an old song that we re-recorded.
Okay.
The weapon.
That one's less annoying.
That's a little less annoying.
That's a little less annoying. I think it's a friendlier little. Oh, you know, we didn't. I was bad. I cut off the little drum. You know, DJs do that. Yeah, I cut.
Well, that means it's like almost like a professional station, because the professional stations, they do that. They cut the stuff.
Well, yeah, that was Mission of Burma, and that was Dirt. Badoom.
Right? There we go. There we go. That makes up for it.
So, of course, that leads to an interesting and yet dumb question. Did you set out to do anything different with the band instrumentally, or did you just set off to continue doing what you're doing? And I mean, because everybody supposedly advances, but I'm just kind of curious.
We didn't think of it any of those ways. We're like a really, I wouldn't say naive or innocent, but we're really non-programmatic. You know, we don't have a plan at all. We just were going to do a few shows. That was what it all was going to be at first. So, you know, we got so we could play, and then it just came back really, really quickly. And we had a lot of people around us that were encouraging us and giving, you know, creative commentary. And so...
Is that a good thing? The creative commentary just kind of trailed off there. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it was good. Like, people would say stuff, and Dave Kleiler, who was in the Volcano Sons. I've already just talked about Dave Kleiler already once. That's good.
Yeah, there you go.
I thought, well, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to play a Strat instead of my lead one guitars. And I brought in the Strat through a Marshall amp, and I thought, is this good? And Dave goes, no, Roger, that's bad. And I go, okay. And then I got the lead ones, and he said, yep, that's it. And you know, he was right. So, I mean, I always listen to people that are around me, but I can usually tell when they're wrong. So it's not a problem.
It's called get the input, listen to it, and make your own decision.
Yeah, that's basically it. But it's nice to have a lot of input. You know, if you're just isolated by yourself, it's not as good. But so we just, you know, and we've all changed a little bit. Clint, sometimes he does his bass solos, and he does different. He'll improvise some of these solos. And he goes, it just amazes me that 20 years ago I'd play it the same way every time. And I go, yeah, Clint, that's called improv. You know, and it was cool. And I've been through some more experimental techniques over the years, so... I mean, the stuff like the beginning of the setup the guitar solo on the setup, which is really guitar and tape loop duet, is pretty out there. And then Fever Moon, I'm playing with a piece of junk metal. And, you know, Pete's played guitar. So, I mean, I don't know. We didn't plan to do anything different, that's for sure.
But so
it's kind of done it. Yeah.
What I'm hearing here, and what people probably don't pay attention to, is that there's an incredible amount of sophistication to get to a certain noise level. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but yeah, I don't think people pay attention to that.
Right. I mean, even when we're utilizing noise, you know, we're sculpting it kind of. You know, we're not just letting it all hang out and just throwing the guitar on the ground and walking away, which, you know, it has its charm also.
But on the alternate Thursday that right works, when that works. So, of course, I have a promo CD here, but I will ask, I wouldn't be proper if I didn't ask the title. Is there any deep meaning to the title?
Did you Enough on?
Yeah.
Well, we were trying to think of a title and nobody could. And then Clint just thought it was similar to kind of our career. Mm-hmm. And also, we play sets that way. When we play at the, whenever we're the headliner, we'll do a set, a short set, 10 or 11 songs, and take a break, and then another 10 or 11 songs, which is on, off, on. But we do it like that. And the CD also has track 9 is 15 seconds of silence.
Right.
So that
should we play that one?
Sure, if you want. That'd okay. be great. We could talk over it, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think we are now.
I think we are. But so the reason why, you know, most bands, they'll play for 2 hours. But you just can't assimilate that much information. You know, when I see a band, usually 5 or 6 songs is enough for me, unless I'm just really blown away. But so we do a 10 or 11 song set, and you have a beginning, and it arches up, and then you draw it to a conclusion, and then there's space. And then when we come back for the second set, it always feels different from the first set. And there's a new starting, and then there's a new conclusion at the end, and then you tag on the encores. So
have you ever found that people who don't know this leave?
No, they never leave, because we always announce it. And
okay.
I mean, if they leave, it's
have a big
they don't
sign like in
the
middle of
anymore.
Sign in the middle of like Gone with the Wind, and it says intermission. Go get some popcorn.
Could be.
Or maybe not. What's on the cover? I mean, there's
you don't
nothing
have the
here.
Cover there?
No,
I have the cover. Just a second.
For those, this is radio, so this is going to work really well on radio. See, I always do.
Maybe I don't have it.
I always ask a question like this.
Switches. There's light switches. There's 3 little switches.
That
one's
are going on,
off,
off on.
Yeah. So it actually, the title isn't printed on the...
They're
going
to get me a real cover. One eventually, but they wanted to get me one fast.
Got
By the way, just so you know, the Target tracks. Let's talk about the Target tracks.
Are there Target tracks?
There are Target tracks on here. Target track, the setup is a Target track.
Really?
Falling is a Target track.
Cool.
The one we're about to play in a mere seconds is a Target track. So
what,
you and I
What track is that?
Number 6, Max Ernst Stream.
That's a Target track?
That's a Target track.
Wow.
It's, well, it's good.
It's
We've picked, out there. But I'm very proud. We've picked a Target track. And also, Target track is on, well, we know Dirt is a Target track.
Oh, that's cool.
So you have Target tracks.
Wow, that's wild.
Should we play a Target track?
Sure.
Okay, here's a Target track. Was Target Track by Mission of Burma.
Target Track, yeah.
Yeah, and Roger, tell me your influence for Target Track. Did you was it about a track or was it about a target?
That was about a target.
That's your '60s progressive radio radio thing. But we'll leave that alone for now. We'll move on to some more exciting questions.
Okay.
I know your hearing loss was way way before rock and roll. But no, needless to say, hearing loss.
No, okay.
Or was it not?
No, it was rock.
Yeah. It was rock.
It was before
rock.
Burma, but
it was
I
before
played in
Burma
bands for 10 years before Burma. So
right,
for 15
and,
years.
And hearing loss greatly affected your career, needless to say, and greatly affected the bands you were in. And as we were just saying during the He's like the nice squeaking.
That's a good squeak.
I
can compete on that.
I was going to say, if you want to tape loop that, we could probably just do like a whole KUSF, you know, Eno album, The Sounds of KUSF. But all serious subject, because I have mine, and had I discovered, you know, earplugs a lot earlier, you know, I wouldn't have my headphones as loud as they are at this very moment, which shows you I still haven't learned. But for them kids out there, you know, I mean, Mission of Burma doesn't play quietly, obviously.
Yes, that is correct.
Because that wouldn't be the thing to do. But what's this, you know, I mean, what do you want to tell them kids out there? Or do you not want to tell them anything?
Well, it's funny. I mean.
And will they listen?
You know, the human ear is designed to hear something about as loud as a tree falling down or something, you know. And then we're just in this environment of just monumentally loud sound. But I consider that need for sound is just it's part of the environment, the urban environment. You know, the sound raises to compete with the environment.
With everything else.
So it makes sense to me. Like when I was in ninth grade, I would just stand in front of the guitar amps of whatever band was there and, you know, just have the sound blow me away. But, you know, obviously your ears aren't designed for that. So I would just encourage, particularly bands that rehearse in small spaces, they should wear earplugs while they're doing it. I mean, most people aren't going to have a career in music no matter what you think about it. But for those that are, you know, it's better to keep.
But you wouldn't
hearing.
Tell them not to play loud. You would.
Well, you can't say that.
Right.
You
because
know,
that
kind of
defeats
can,
the
I
purpose.
I can tell them that it's stupid. It's you know, why are humans so stupid?
Right.
But I do it.
Well, or you could turn around and say, if you're going to play loud, play well. You know, or the
that's
other way to look at
it,
well, or let me put it a completely different way. I guess I think I can say it, my bitch is, you know, you were talking about the Marshall amp and playing the right mm-hmm. guitar. And I would imagine that your PA, you know, being who you are, you probably pay a fair amount of attention to it. And I think that, you know, playing loud is one thing, playing badly, you know, sacrificing bad sound is a whole nother ball of wax.
Right. Well, Bob Weston is the tape loop guy. He's taken Martin's place in Burma, and he's a really good live sound mixer. So I believe that he generally takes care of us quite well in that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really important.
I discovered, and then you'll be, just to tell you how obsessed I am with strange things, that there's a documentary in progress on Mission of Burma.
Oh, right.
And ironically enough, I gave Matador site has the trailer for the doc up there.
I think the CD you have also might have it.
Does it? And then I called Boston this afternoon, and there he was at the National Association of Broadcasters show. I called Aaron, the guy who's in charge of making it, and he turned around.
You called
and
who?
His name is Aaron.
Oh, yeah,
Aaron. Yeah, and I called him, and I got him.
Aram.
I'm pronouncing
Aram. I've done soundtrack work for
and
him.
And I got him on, and it turns out that I started in a recording studio in Boston as a recording engineer years ago called J. Rose Sound, which was at 171 Newberry Street. Which was right above September Productions, which he used
to work.
So we got into this whole.
In September, huh?
Yeah, so we got into this whole thing. But he mentioned that he's got another 200 hours to cull down into a film.
It's a nightmare.
And then he turned around and said, and this is why I'm bringing this up, because we're on the air, why not? He said he's looking for more money to make that happen.
Sure.
So how do you feel about a documentary about, you know, you started this thing, you did it with a whole different purpose, and now there's going to be a documentary.
Well, it was really weird. You know, when the band reformed, we were constantly being filmed. And it was just so bizarre. You know, every rehearsal would be filmed. I'd be driving to the first show or someone else would be driving so that I could talk to somebody else while someone else was filming it. It was perpetual filming.
After
a while, it just became part of the kind of bizarre. It was just so bizarre. I can't begin to.
I mean, he's got
it. Bizarre, the initial reformation. It was like our feet, you know, it's just you could never.
Yeah, but at least VH1, it's funny, at South by Southwest, I hung with John Easdale of Dramarama, and at least VH1 didn't show up at your door and knock on the door and say, hi, you're reforming the band.
But these were our friends.
Right.
I mean, everybody that was shooting us were people we knew, so it was about as comfortable as you could possibly get. But, you know, for that 2 or 3 weeks, it was perpetual filming, and it was part of our life was that we were being filmed for this documentary. And then as soon as they stopped shooting it, I've basically forgotten about it entirely. You know, if something comes out of it, great. If nothing does, I couldn't care less, really.
Have you seen, like, the Metallica doc, or have you seen Dig, or any of these other ones that are...
No. I did see Spinal Tap. that's the frightening one.
Yeah, well, and that wasn't a that was way too true, wasn't it?
That was way too true. Every musician or anybody who knows about music fidgets throughout the entire film.
So the penultimate question, which you know, you don't do a good interview if you don't ask it, and then you land up with something really either really good as an answer or like, why are you asking me this? What's in the CD player these days? Like, what are you listening to that you're saying either, you know, boy, I can absorb that and I can make that, you know, I can advance that and do some great things with it, or I don't want to take you down the path of what's yucky in your life, because that's always a pain in the neck.
I'm trying to remember what I listen to. It's so diverse, and you know, I'll just listen to something briefly and then it goes on. I mean, I was listening to a tango CD, which doesn't have too much to do with my current music exactly. And I was listening to my brother, Mr. Lawrence, who's one of my younger brothers, and he does kids music in kind of a British invasion style, but it's incredibly kind of surreal.
Is it out? My daughter would probably love
it. Yeah, she probably would. In fact, a lot of people like it, but he doesn't have a real marketing for it. But
his
stuff is really, really interesting. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. Pretty Girls Make Graves I really like. I think they might be playing with Burma when we're here. I mean, I love Wire. As far as rock music, I'm trying to focus in on something. But it's a lot of Sun Ra. A friend of mine, I teach guitar lessons, and he just loaned me 20 Sun Ra CDs.
Wow.
Of which I already had 10 on vinyl, but I was just listening to nothing but Sun Ra for a couple of weeks. That was really great.
Anything else question number 16, anything else we haven't covered? Anything else you'd like? Roger Miller, this is your chance to let the world know.
This is your chance.
You know, maybe I did a really sucky interview, and maybe I missed some divine momentous question that I was supposed to ask.
If you did, you know, I don't know what that would be. So.
All right. So then we missed a band member, didn't we? Theoretically, musically.
What do you
mean? Is that why we're playing this last track? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is for Pete, because the other ones, Clint wrote two of those, I don't even know what songs you played. But Clint and I were both represented, so I figured it's
time. This interview never happened.
To get Pete in line here. This is The Enthusiast from the new album.
Great.
It's a really cool tune.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time.
Yeah,
and I don't know exactly when people are exactly going to be hearing this, whether we're in this debate, whether it's upon album release or when you're here, or I think there was a vote in the room to play it twice. So that's what we'll do.
Play twice before actually playing it.
Excellent. Well, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dan. Just enjoy the wait, admire the place.